Let me start off by talking a little bit about infrastructure and why it's so important that we need to figure out what's going on. We just came out of the climate change scenario a couple of minutes ago, and all of us are having to deal with infrastructure changes that are resulting from climate change, but we're also having to deal with infrastructure problems that have occurred because, as a nation, we have not done a very good job of keeping up with things as they're falling apart. And so it's important that we figure out how to cover these stories. And I've got two panelists for you today. I apologize, one of our panelists from Oklahoma University could not attend today. And the Corps of Engineers could never get their act together to send me anybody, so I'm going to give the Corps presentation, sort of a repeat for those of you who are in New Orleans, a little bit of information about the status of rebuilding the New Orleans system. So on my left is Shelley Chard McClary. She's been Division Director of the Water Quality Division of the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality since January 2010 and has 23 years of experience in the drinking water and wastewater arena. And so she knows a heck of a lot about what's going on in terms of infrastructure and the ability to keep up with things as they're disappearing. She's also on the board of directors for the Oklahoma Water Environment Association, the Groundwater Protection Council, and past president of the Association of Clean Water Administrators, and is a member of the Collection Systems Committee in the House of Delegates of the Water Environment Federation. And she is here in part because I begged the Water Environment Federation to help me out and find somebody who knows what the heck they're talking about. So I appreciate her being here. To her left is Kenneth Smith. He's got 39 years of experience in water resource engineering. He's a member of the American Society of Civil Engineers and past president of the Association of State Dam Safety Officials. And he's also served on the National Dam Safety Board of Review. At the moment, he's the Assistant Director of the Division of Water at the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, where he's responsible for the division's compliance and projects branch, which includes the state's dam and levee safety section. I'm going to leave it at that. And if I could, I'd like, Kenneth, if you could start out and with your little show. Can we do that?
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having us come and talk this morning about infrastructure and America. As I prepared to come and speak at this, the one thing that I noticed were that the three organizations, the two that I'm here representing, the Society of Civil Engineers and particularly the Association of State Dam Safety Officials, how we seem to share a common link with the Society for Environmental Journalists, that being very much a desire to educate the public and try to bring science-based information to the public so they can understand some of the issues and things that were going on. It particularly was the thing that motivated me to want to really come and do the presentation and get a chance to open up the line of communications between the societies. One of the things that I didn't bother to put in my bio, but I am the communications committee chairman for ASDSO, and along with the ASDSO small staff in Lexington, are often involved trying to address reporters' questions or get some information out to them and try to work with the public. So I really kind of felt that the chance to begin to open up that communications with our societies was really kind of an important thing. There are, let's see if it's going to work for me. There we go. Three key topics that I really wanted to cover here for a few minutes this morning. I'm going to talk about ASCE's infrastructure report card, specifically talk a little bit about dams and levees. I'm going to talk about safety of dams more. That's really the area that's truly my expertise, and a little bit of the relationship or lack thereof with flood insurance program in the nation, which really drives a lot of the floodplain management programs that are out there. And I'm going to talk about a third topic that I care a great deal about, even though there is no such program in my state or most states, and that's really the topic of safety at dams, safety of recreators. It's an important topic. I just think we need to be perhaps working together to try to do some things. So let's talk a little bit about the report card. There are several versions of it that are out there now. About every 4 years, ASCE gathers together a bunch of experts in various sectors in order to assess the current state of infrastructure in America, and then also talk a little bit about the future, future needs, and kind of what needs to be done. Obviously, the first step in creating a report card is to define what success and failure looks like. And they did that through a national vision that was created that said what we are striving for is an economy that's really competitive in the world because of having a first-class infrastructure system. The report card then measures where we are right now and the many areas that we aren't doing so well in. We're really failing to keep pace with current and expanding needs, and an investment right now seems to really be falling and falling behind what's needed on the infrastructure. So what do the grades mean you're going to see on this report card in a minute? I think we all understand the notion of what an A means. It's fit for the future. It's something nobody needs to worry about. Don't worry, you aren't going to see any A's on the report card. B would kind of mean good. We're sort of used to this as parents. Adequate for now. There's only one of those on the report card. A C, as in what your children would bring home with a C, means things are kind of mediocre. There probably are signs of deterioration, some sort of significant deficiencies as far as infrastructure. It means there's vulnerability to risk there. A D would mean that elements are approaching the end of their useful life. There's significant deterioration. There is concern for the risk of failure. And an F, it would mean the pieces of infrastructure really aren't fit for their purpose anymore. There's really exhibiting signs of imminent failure. With that, this is the report card from 2013. I don't know if you've seen it before, but overall, the country's infrastructure is sitting in a D plus. Many areas of the infrastructure aren't seeing the investment needs to improve even day-to-day performance. The backlogs of projects is growing, let alone even what is needed to modernize things. There really are very few bright spots on that report card. The only exception, I think, being the solid waste area that actually got a fairly decent grade. But it's sort of a grim picture of where we're at right now. ASCE then looked at, so what's this really mean over an 8-year period? These are funding numbers that they were looking at for the period from 2013 to 2020 across the 16 infrastructures. And all their goal was what's it take to bring the grades up to a B, which basically means, you know, have them be adequate for now, not really even looking into the future. And to me, kind of cutting to the chase of what the numbers mean is the nation, our states, the communities collectively are only spending about half what they need to be spending to get to a level of a B. And, you know, currently they're spending at the levels of 2013 at $2 trillion, where what they really need to be spending is something close to $4. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about dams. Safety of dams. It's a national concern. By safety of dams, what I'm really talking about is the structural safety, the integrity of the design. Is it what it should be, and has it been taken care of? Every year, I hope as journalists you're aware that there is a National Dam Safety Day. It occurs on May 31st and commemorates the failure of the South Fork Dam in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which happened in 1889. It was, that particular dam failure was the worst that we've ever had in the country so far. Over 2,200 lives were lost. This monument is a monument that is created in commemorance of over 700 of those that are lost, buried here in the background, who were never even able to be identified. Their remains were not able to be identified. If you ever really want to make a pilgrimage somewhere where you can see what poor infrastructure means, I would strongly suggest a trip to Johnstown, Pennsylvania. There is a national memorial there. There are several sites. You can still stand on the abutments and look at the valley where the dam once stood. It is a very, very moving experience. I made it once about 20 years ago, and I'll be honest, I've never been the same since. National Dam Safety Day was created to encourage and promote community and individual responsibility, educate best practices, to show steps stakeholders can use to try to impact the future. And it's not just about a historic event, it's certainly something that is a vision and a goal for the future that we really need to talk about, because the grades for dams in our country were a D. There are about 87,000 dams in the United States, scattered across all of the states. The average age for those dams is in excess of 50 years old at this point. There are many things that could be done to raise the grade above a D, particularly thinking of rehabilitation and repair funding needs to occur for many of these dams. There need to be emergency action plans developed for dams everywhere in practice, so that the communities know how to respond when the dams get in trouble. There needs to be awareness campaigns, and there certainly seems to be the need to encourage and create incentives for governors and legislators to provide resources needed for the agencies. Most of these 87,000 dams are regulated at the state level. There is not a national program that regulates dams, other than the national programs, such as where the Corps of Engineers owns a dam. They're owners, they really aren't regulators, they're owners of them. All dams in the country and all states are regulated by state agencies, such as the one I work for. And that particularly is relevant when you look at the next slide about ownership. I think there is a huge misconception in the country with everybody I talk to, where they think the government owns all dams. That is very incorrect. Across the nation, 70% of all dams are in private ownership. I did a little research on South Carolina right before I came, because of what's obviously going on there. In their state, the number's even higher. It's in excess of 80% of all dams are in private ownership. That means one private individual, possibly two private individuals, maybe it's a homeowners association, but they are in private ownership. It also, I think, makes the infrastructure of dams very different than other infrastructure in our country. Now, I said I'd say something about the National Flood Insurance Program and dams, and that leads me to these two slides. This one is just a schematic. This is a wonderful community. That yellow thing is the minimum standard 100-year flood insurance requirement area floodplain for that stream. This wonderful community was so thoughtful that they've kept all of their homes and facilities located outside of that flood insurance floodplain area. Unfortunately, this community allows a dam to get built. That is an expectation of what the dam failure floodplain would look like should that dam go. Typically, when dams fail, they create a flood wave 5-10 times larger than that little minimum standard 100-year floodplain. And people that had bought into the misconception that that minimum standard flood protected them get a very rude awakening, like many people in South Carolina have gotten, where they have damage that is beyond their wildest expectations and dreams, just because they've never really been informed that there still is a larger risk out there beyond what was covered by the little minimum standard floodplain programs that exist. Now, I could talk forever about dams. Honestly, I could sit up here and talk for 2 hours probably. The one thing I really want to point you to is on the ASDSO website, a document that is there called Living with Dams, Know Your Risks. It's a lot of useful information. It's a very good document that I was actually part of the committee that put that on there. We've done a second companion document about extreme storm events, trying to explain why dams are design standards go for larger extreme events, not that little minimum 100-year insurance standard. But very good information in that and on the ASDSO website in general. Let's talk about levees for a minute. The one thing I really hope, a phrase that sticks with you after this, is the phrase residual risk. I think that applies to most anything that is designed. The public never hears that phrase much, though. They hear, oh, we've designed something, and we're cutting a ribbon today on this new flood control project, and they think somehow all risk is now gone because someone made a levee. They don't understand the concepts of minimum standards and design and residual risk that still exists behind things that are done. There was a law professor, Dennis Binder, who I'm really butchering his quote right now, but I've used it often. He says, relying upon a minimal standard of care or minimum law really poses great risk when reasonable prudence requires higher care. We need to understand that when levees are designed, they aren't designed for worst case scenarios. Finances always seem to come into the equation when people do design work. They're designed typically for minimum standards. And when infrequent worst conditions can happen, and they eventually do happen, there's consequences. And I think we all certainly saw those consequences in New Orleans about 10 years ago. We really need to remember and pass on this concept of residual risk to the public. Levees also got a D, in this case a D minus for the nation, probably for very good reason. There are over 100,000 miles of levees in the country. They can be found in all 50 states. They are in the District of Columbia. It's amazing where, when you start looking, levees seem to pop up. Levees and what I call levee-like structures, typically were often originally built to protect farmland. And because of that, they were built to lower standards than you would typically expect to see for things in urban areas. Unfortunately, urban areas often seem to get built behind things that used to be agricultural levees. And again, since the public doesn't seem to understand that concept of residual risk, or risk that still is behind a man-made structure, people are in places where they don't truly understand what's around them. The fact that levees got a grade of D shouldn't really surprise anybody, I hope. This image from 10 years ago in New Orleans has been one that has stuck with me forever. I was horrified sitting watching television and watching levees come apart and what happened to that community because people didn't seem to understand that things aren't worst-case designs in this country. They're really smaller standards. Now, some levees have been repaired, but I think there are still many more levees everywhere throughout the country that are aging, that have had questionable activities around them over the years. And that there is that risk behind them that people need to understand. One of the things that has scared me a lot with old levees like this one that have been in place is, I think you've all seen them, you know what I mean by a directional boring machine? It's a neat little tool contractors use. They can drill a hole without having to dig a trench. They can dig a hole under things and then shove a pipeline wherever they think they need to put it. Whether it's a water line, a sewer line, a conduit to shove internet cable through or phone cables or whatever, directional boring machines. The things are used everywhere. They do it and they don't even understand necessarily where they're drilling. It is not uncommon to find that they have gone under levees, through their foundations, under structures. I've actually run into places where they have drilled through dams and compromised the foundations of dams because they're really unaware of what's in that area and the meaning of basically breaking up that foundation and weakening it and causing the ability for water to then come under a pipe under it and cause a structural failure in the future. I thought this was interesting. In ASC studies, they managed to show that and show there's actually an economic effect to all individuals in the country of loss of disposable income if we don't address the failing infrastructure. I can only briefly cover the report card in this talk. I hope you go back and look at it more closely. You know, the country and its success we've had for the last decades was clearly built on the fact that we had very good infrastructure. And that infrastructure now is reaching the end of its useful life. I think if we fail to act, if we fail to truly begin to fund the infrastructure in many ways, it makes me worried about the future. And that's a story I know we need your help to keep in the public's mind. Now there's a particular topic I want to hit because it's something I care a lot about, and we've had multiple deaths in our state in the last few years. The topic about safety at dams. It's very different than safety of dams. Safety of dams looks at the typical thing when people say dam safety, they're thinking the structural stability of that structure. Safety at dams is about recreational safety. It's a very different kind of topic. At these low head dams, they may not seem like they pose much risk when water flow is low. They can be deceivingly dangerous to the public when they have gotten used to them in low flow, and then a mild flooding event occurs, they become much different animals. They create strong recirculating currents that trap victims and drown them because they can't get away from the structure and get downstream or get out to the sides. The flow over those structures actually just keeps pushing the people down and down and recirculating them, sort of as that schematic shows. They are known as drowning machines, these low-head dams. They are everywhere across the country. Most states do not even have a program that addresses these structures. And it's not just one program in my mind. I think it's something that very much needs to be a multidisciplined approach and many agency and organization approach. And it's something clearly because of the communication side, that needs to be done in partnerships with private sector and with journalism. I can't speak of the danger of these things enough. It is very difficult for anyone to escape these recirculating currents once they go over the structures and get trapped in them. There is a group from Brigham Young University that's been studying the issue and doing some documentation. If I would suggest you go try to find them and their website. These are locations that they have documented over the last several decades of deaths around the country where people have died at low head dams. As I said, in my own state, there have been four within about the last year. And although there are no initiatives to really deal with these structures in most states, even at the nation, I think some of us that have sat around, we still understand what needs to be done. There are some professionals that care enough about the topic that in professional society settings such as this, we've sat and kind of gathered what needs to be done. How do we, from behind the scenes, encourage the nation to start dealing with it? We know there's an education that needs to be done. There even needs to be basic inventory and ownership research done on these structures. The issue of signage comes up often. Mandating signage, I'm not certain, never seems to go over real well when you talk with legislators about mandating anything new. They start seeing dollar signs in their mind and new agencies that need to get created and staff that needs to be created and enforcement staff that needs to exist and vehicles you need to buy for the enforcement staff and lawyers you need to hire for the enforcement staff. You don't seem to get anywhere real quick when you start talking about mandating signage. I think there are ways to approach this on an incentive basis where you can incentivize owners to do the right things. I've seen that done in the state of Virginia, and it was kind of interesting. And I think it could be a model that could be discussed in a lot of places. I think incentives to owners of structures, again, remembering 80-some percent of these things may be privately owned, and they don't, other than their own income, they don't have funding sources. I think you need to look at incentives a lot. It stuns me how little ability law enforcement has to actually create exclusion zones to keep people away from this. They don't have that ability, and I've been floored by that. And certainly some of these things, I think, they are so old and pointless anymore. They were created 100 years ago or more ago for a purpose that no longer exists. We just need to figure out how to decommission them. That takes money to take them out or to alter them. But it's certainly something that I think we need to be doing, trying to get rid of them. I've got like two slides left, and then I'm going to pass the work here real quick. So I know we particularly need your help with education. We understand that we need to be educating the teens, the youth in the country, and we can't do that without you. I hope none of you ever put mixed messages out like this. I've seen this where organizations were actually encouraging people to come to their community because they had these neat little things to go play in. I was horrified by that. I hope you never do that. Please reach out to the organizations. There is a lot of good information and people that would love to work with you on these things if you have information. Thank you.
Okay, give me half a second here to get Shelby's presentation up. Okay, you're set.
Okay, I'm Shelly Char McClary. I am the Water Quality Division Director with the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality. Today I'm kind of wearing two hats, and I'm going to switch them back and forth probably multiple times. I am filling in for the Deputy Director of the Water Environment Federation, who had a health issue and was unable to make this trip. So I'm going to talk about some national issues representing WEF, and then I'm going to also talk about some specific things that relate here in Oklahoma. And so I don't forget to do it. Lori Harrison is back over here. She has some information specifically about WEF and some documents they've put together, and she'll be happy to talk with you about some of those issues. I have a tendency to do two things. One, I get wound up and I start talking really, really fast. And the other is I will get on my soapbox, and there are certain things I feel really strongly about. So I promised I would try to, you know, stay in this middle ground and talk about the issues at hand and not wander off too far on some of my own kind of pet issues. So first of all, just a little bit about the Water Environment Federation. This is an international organization that works with all sorts of people, creating all kinds of valuable resources for technical plant operators, working with various consulting groups who are working with the operators, academics, all kinds of people. I really appreciate WEF giving me the opportunity, but so I can get on my soapbox a little bit as I talk to you about some really important things that impact water and wastewater in this country right now. So just very briefly, WEF's mission is to connect water professionals, enrich their expertise, and increase awareness about water and water issues. And they also provide a platform where people like me, the operators, the consultants, the regulators, that we have the opportunity to spend time together at regional meetings, national meetings, and really talk about pressing issues and issues where we need some guidance. Over the last few years, we've seen more and more of the press being involved, attending at least WEF Tech every year, some of the bigger meetings. So there's really a lot of opportunity to connect with people with their feet on the ground, dealing with whatever the pressing issues are of today and looking ahead to those things we anticipate needing to address in the coming years. And I can assure you, the pumps, the pipes, and the dollars that go with it, huge focus for all of us. It's kind of nice to have kind of that national umbrella to help us address some of those issues. This just kind of gives you an idea of who makes up the Water Environment Federation. Pretty much anybody that has any piece of water and wastewater are going to show up in this group. It's engineers, it's lab techs, it's consultants, it's operators, it's regulators, maintenance workers, it's everybody. And it's really a unique opportunity to sit down and have some discussions that we so often have with people who do similar jobs that we do, but we don't often branch out and have those broader discussions. And I have found, particularly in dealing with certain challenges that I'll talk about in a few minutes related to drought, flooding, those types of activities, it's very helpful to have that different perspective. And I think that would be a great opportunity for journalists to kind of connect with all of those different groups and hear the same story or the same event retold, but from the different perspectives. And sometimes that's very fascinating. At everyone's perspective, when you put it all together, it paints quite a picture. So what I'm going to do is just kind of talk briefly about some national needs related to water and wastewater industry, kind of some things WEF is doing on the congressional level. The new Stormwater Institute, that's something that's brand new and is proving very helpful already. And we're also going to talk just briefly about the Value of Water Coalition. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with that, but I hope in the next few months you get very familiar. There are a lot of great activities that are coming from there. And then, like I said, I'm going to kind of throw in some tidbits from my own state and some things that we've been dealing with over the last, really the last year, but it is very cyclical. So right now, it's the water sector, we're really kind of at a crossroads. There have been a lot of things happen. The Clean Water Act was passed 40 years ago. We have gone from, 40-year-old congressional rule law, a million pages long, plus or minus a few, to an age of technology and needing to be able to respond, social media and that instant access to information it's very difficult sometimes when you're dealing with a law that was written 40 years ago when you really weren't even doing much with computers, let alone reaching out and educating through these other tools and addressing regulation through those tools. We've done a really good job addressing point sources. These are our discharge permits, cities, industries, how much pollutants they're allowed to put into a stream. But we really haven't gone very far addressing some of the non-point source issues, some of the runoff issues. Those of you from the Great Lakes area are familiar with some of those challenges, the hypoxia zone, the Mississippi River, looking at the Chesapeake Bay. Those are the big ones you hear about, but you don't necessarily hear about Flint Creek in Oklahoma and some of the challenges that all of the states are facing while addressing non-point source pollution as well. We're also seeing a shift in our utilities. We used to have wastewater treatment plants. They were sewer plants. Well, now they're resource recovery facilities. We're moving away from this is a waste product to maybe this is a resource. What can we do? How can we approach this differently? And we have to advance with the changing conditions. So the Water Environment Federation, a lot of facilities, a lot of states are really taking an active role in trying to move forward. Well, you can read this, huge gap. This shouldn't be news. There's been a lot of talk about, why we have degrades on infrastructure. The funding isn't being allocated either at the federal level, the state level, the consumer level. It's water. It should be free. We don't think about the cost of transporting and treating water, of transporting wastewater and converting it into a usable product. We are looking at a $2 trillion need over the next 25 years. That's pretty significant. When you look at my state, geography, we're a pretty good sized state, but when you look at population, we're just a little over 3.5 million people. This year, through our federal dollars that we leverage, issue bonds, we couple it with other funding, we have $58 million available for drinking water systems, but we have $254 million in need. Not hard to see that if we don't figure this out and do things a little better, add additional funding, we're not going to advance in the report card that was earlier talked about. We're going to stay where we are or decline even further. So this next slide, again, I'm not going to read it to you. You can look at it. But historically, when people talk about infrastructure funding, what do we talk about? Roads and bridges. Why? We see it. We've got to have it for commerce. Well, because of Katrina, we start talking about levees. Anybody in here from Oklahoma? I'm not recognizing anybody. Okay. One? Okay. we had some of the worst flooding we've had in the history back in April and May. We had the wettest 45-day period. All of those privately owned dams that were discussed earlier, well, one about 500 yards from my back door failed. It was owned by a church. It's a big deal. We have to start focusing more than just roads and bridges when we talk about infrastructure. We talk about schools. We need funding for schools. Critically important, but we have to talk about our water and wastewater infrastructure. Without that, we cannot be successful. We cannot have economic development. When we start talking about our needs, we have to remember without water, a human being can only survive about a week. You can go a month without food. So there are things like that we need to think about. We need to reconnect the public health piece of water and wastewater infrastructure. While it's an environmental program for most states, it's really public health that we're talking about and the protection of public health. So that's critically important when we make some of those connections, and why should we spend the money we need to spend in order to convey water where we need it and to move forward and continue to develop. There are so many construction projects that come about every year as water or wastewater facilities are built, expanded, new pipes, new pumps. That creates a large amount of economic development in paying wages to individuals, paying the purchase of equipment. So we see a lot of economic development driven by the water industry and protecting infrastructure. And I think that part gets left out when we talk about loaning or granting $1 million to a small community for upgrades or repairs. Okay, it's $1 million, fine. But a lot of that $1 million goes to salaries. So it does have an impact. And when we look at some of the ERA funding that the Obama administration did a few years ago, there was a huge influx of dollars into communities. It wasn't just the building and the repairing of infrastructure. If we fail to do some of that work, we're going to see job losses as well, because when we aren't maintaining, expanding, doing the things we need to do, we see the negative impact as well. Sorry, that was kind of a soapbox moment, and I'll try to get back off of it. We look at some of the activities that the Water Environment Federation really enables people across the country to engage together and speak with a larger voice. You know, we are able to talk more directly about some of the state revolving fund programs, trying to get those programs reauthorized so they continue in effect. This is money that Congress gives to EPA, then it comes to the states to administer. Some states just simply loan out that number of dollars to their communities. Some states, like mine, we issue bonds, we leverage that money and are able, depending on the bond market, to anywhere from quadruple that federal dollar allocation, and in really good years, up to 9 times the amount of money. These communities, they repay that money, so it does revolve, so we get it back so we can do it again. That's critically important. WEF has been involved with several of the state regulator organizations and with EPA on integrated planning. This is kind of EPA taking a new approach. Instead of everything has to be an enforcement action, you do not meet the compliance standards, you've got 3 years to meet it or else. But a lot of times when we're talking to particularly smaller utilities, well, you know, okay, fine, you fine me $10,000 a day, now I'm bankrupt, what are you going to do the next day? We still have a problem. How do we fix it? EPA has done a great job on integrated planning, working with the states, kind of giving another tool to negotiate what are the biggest concerns for this community, this region. How can we take the limited dollars and get the best bang for our buck? Maybe we have to be more flexible. Maybe we make changes to permits. Maybe we just make a change in deadlines. Maybe we get a couple of communities to work together to resolve an issue. So that's something, again, I could get on that soapbox for a while, but I'll not. Tax-exempt bonds. There are some that would like to do away with that. It's pretty beneficial for communities. It's a way that we do a lot of funding, a lot of construction gets done. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Water innovation. Sometimes you just need to have the right people in the room having the conversation to figure out maybe there is a better way instead of just doing things the way we've always done them. And sometimes for Congress that's particularly challenging. Working for a state agency, I get the bureaucracy that is just inherently built into government. But if we can get, you know, some openness in Congress to some innovative solutions and possibilities, that may give us a little relief and a little bit of push down that path. And then utilities of the future. That's an effort that WEF and several utility groups have been working on, and it's think about things differently. We're not a sewer plant anymore. We're not a wastewater plant anymore. We are a water resource recovery facility. We are a resource recovery, not just dealing with water, but also the energy and things along those lines that we can also recover that can go as another income stream. We start looking at how can we update the Clean Water Act to make it, you know, more in line with this century as opposed to the way we've thought about things in the past. Budget is always a big deal. You can't talk to anybody in any level of government and not hear budget. You know, we deal with, well, there's a president's proposed budget, the congressional staff proposed budget, the negotiations. Oh, well, then we can't even get a bill, so we have continuing resolutions. But when we look at the budget for the Environmental Protection Agency, sometimes people don't understand so much of that money is passed through to states in order to loan or grant that money to communities to actually do the work. The big issue on this, if you take nothing else away, is the ask of Congress to restore the funding for the state revolving funds. That's how we fund the bulk of our infrastructure. The tax-exempt bonds, this is if the changes occur that kind of come around from year to year or every two or three, it really impacts the ability of communities to issue bonds. Nobody wants to buy them. They're no longer tax-exempt. And when you look at this slide, again, there's a lot of information, but what you need to know is the red is the tax-exempt bonds that fund infrastructure for water and wastewater for communities. That's a big gap. Okay, so we talk about infrastructure in terms of the piping and the pumps, but it's more than just that. It's everything associated. It's the treatment facilities. And now, is it really just treatment or is it a recovery opportunity? We can recover energy. In some places, we have facilities that are uploading their excess electric capacity to the grid, and it's an electricity producer, not only for the facility, but for surrounding areas. We have nutrient recovery. That, again, becomes a product. These are things that what was the sewer plant is now contributing to the economic health of the community it serves. It's not only producing this very clean water, but it's producing electricity, it's producing nutrients, it's producing other viable products. Recently, the nutrient roadmap was completed by WEF and several utilities. And there's a nutrient and energy roadmap that was done. This is available to anyone that can contact WEF, go to the website, get that information. And again, this is an opportunity of communities to have not only the treatment they need, but a resource that contributes to the economic health. In Oklahoma, we're looking at how can we address some impacted streams and that have high levels of nutrients. Well, maybe we can start addressing some of these issues at both industrial and municipal resource recovery facilities rather than simply putting this nitrogen and phosphorus into our rivers. Stormwater is a big issue that we're all talking about. Currently, the flooding on the East Coast. We did flooding in April and May. Stormwater, you know, it's just rain. It falls from the sky. Here it is. What do we do with it? When we start looking at trying to come up with alternative sources of water for drought and those types of issues, stormwater is an area that we need to capture and think about what we're going to do. And because that was kind of such, it wasn't really a vacuum of no information. It wasn't a lot of cohesive information. WEF put together the Stormwater Institute. This was just unveiled in the last few weeks. It's a great resource, a great opportunity. Our stormwater communities now have one place they can go and access information. We work very closely in Oklahoma with the Central Oklahoma Stormwater Association, and it's just a bunch of communities that put themselves together and said, we need some help, we need information, we need people to talk to. So we do now have kind of a national umbrella of where we can go and get some of that information. The first product was released, and I believe we have in the back of the room, the rainfall to results. So please feel free to pick that up, and Lori can answer questions for you on that. I know I'm getting close on time, so I'm gonna talk really fast because this is really important. the Value of Water Coalition, I would really encourage all of you to take a look at the information. We had all kinds of different water associations and groups talking about how important water was, but we were all talking about it from our own perspective, and so I was talking to people who were kind of like me instead of getting the message out. We had to figure out how to make people smarter about water, and here you can see the list of organizations that are heavily involved. They do have a website and a campaign. This was just launched earlier, a couple of months ago. You can look at the toolkit on thevalueofwater.org. It has all kinds of information, and its whole focus is, what really is the value of water? Why do we need water? I drink it and I swim in it. But this really talks about why it's important. And since August, the toolkit has been downloaded over 1,500 times, so it will be a great resource. Just wrapped up, Imagine a Day Without Water campaign throughout the country. I don't know how many of you use Thunderclap or know about it. Another social media campaign. The first campaign just about wrapped up. We had over 600,000 people were included in all of these efforts. We're trying to focus the message on what things would look like without water. We talk about drought. We start looking at the lifespan of our pipes. We've had pipes in the ground for 100, 150 years. Typical lifespan is, 50, 60 tops. We talk about innovative cities who are replacing 1% of their pipe every year. That means 50-year pipe is going to be in the ground, double its expected lifespan. So there are a lot of things that we need to do to educate everyone about how we can replace that pipe and do it in an economically viable way. It's going to cost money, but we have to figure out how to do it. Anybody who wants information on value of water, there is the contact information. And then anyone who would like information on the Water Environment Federation, here's contact information, and Lori is here. And I know I flew through all of this. If you want information about Oklahoma-specific activities, I'll be around for a while. My Office of Communications Director and some of her staff are here manning a booth, and you can contact us. Here, and I will leave some of my cards, and I will stop talking.
I'm going to go ahead and move directly to questions because I think nobody wants to hear me give the core spiel. So can we have a couple of questions from the audience? Anybody want to talk about some things? If you could identify yourself.
It's on. Kathy Kowalski, Science News for Students, Midwest Energy News, Muse, other freelance publications. One of the elephants in the room is climate change, and we've heard about more extreme storms coming, more extreme demands. And I'm assuming that the figures you both showed are not taking that into account. So how are the projections worse in light of climate change, and what else do we need to do in order to have a passing grade for infrastructure given climate change?
So some of the numbers that I talked about specific to Oklahoma, we are looking at, we don't necessarily couch it in terms of climate change. Again, there's that whole political buzz around that, that sometimes that's more difficult for us to talk in those terms. But we definitely talk about extreme or severe weather events, you know, Tornado Alley. We've seen some pretty significant tornadoes, very large. We see the drought issue for us has been huge. Our Secretary of Energy and Environment made the comment that I thought, I'm keeping that with me, and that's going to become part of my language, is we don't end drought. We're not out of drought. Drought just got interrupted. For Oklahoma and Texas, drought gets interrupted. It doesn't really go away very long. So things that we're looking at are things like water reuse. How do we do that? How do we expand? How do we take our resource recovery facilities and turn that water into industrial use water, turn that maybe into drinking water at some point? How do we use that in our oil and gas exploration and production? And so those kinds of costs do show up in some of our numbers because we do have rules in place or under development. But all of that to say, the cost needed is going to go up dramatically, and the amount of dollars available will probably continue to decline until something happens, and as a country, we shift priorities to our water and wastewater infrastructure. And I guess with that, I'll stop and I'll let you comment on the dams aspect.
Well, when I think of the whole report card in general, I'm not sure that the report card really is addressing that future in the money figures that it talks about, because the goal, the vision of what they were hoping for was just a grade of B, and a B was being adequate for now. And so if you really start looking at that, at all of those infrastructure numbers about how to be prepared for the future, I think you begin to have to address what we're seeing, the extreme events that are becoming more common, and the cost for infrastructure replacement and repair and dealing with those and really being prepared for the future are going to go up to some extent. With regard to high hazard dams, and part of the numbers in the dam section specifically, a high hazard dam by definition is a dam that should it fail, it's going to cause loss of life downstream and extreme damage to the structure. For at least the last 40 years, when I look back in the literature, I think the dam design requirements have already been looking towards extreme events. Typically, the national expectations for high hazard dams haven't used the phrase extreme events. They were tied to a phrase called PMP, probable maximum precipitation, and it had numbers associated with it that whenever we talked about it, people thought we were related to NOAA and or that we were just idiots. But we just saw those numbers happen in South Carolina, and over the last several years, ASDSO's begun to try to change the way us engineers talk about those design standards and just start using the terminology really we've gotten from you about extreme events, because that's really what was in it. We can't design for little minimum standards when you're dealing with things that affect people's lives. And we've always recognized that you need to go beyond those minimum standards for dam design, for spillway capacity, for the structural integrity that should be there, because these things, someone this morning was saying a lot of the events you see, they're really man-induced or man-caused disasters. And I think that particularly comes true with dams. The dam is a man-made structure. If it fails, the disaster it causes is a man-made disaster. Now, it may have been triggered by an extreme weather event or something, but these are things that man builds and man's in control of. And thankfully, at least, the engineering profession has, over the years with regard to these high hazard dams, recognized that we needed to be dealing with extreme events in the designs. So I think some of that dealing with the extreme events and the money that will cost to do it is already recognized in the dam component of infrastructure.
And for the Army Corps of Engineers, the reality is that the Corps has been designing structures for potential for sea level rise and other issues involved with climate change for quite a while, and have updated that. And in fact, when the levee system in New Orleans was built, they had to, in the middle of what they were doing, upgrade some of the heights of the levees to address an increase in the way that the Corps was looking at the potential effects of climate change.
Answer fast because I got to leave in 5 minutes. I'm Christy George. I'm an independent producer in public broadcasting in Oregon. And you talked about a paradigm shift, Shelley, in around, you know, wastewater treatment is now really resource recovery. And I'm wondering for both of you, what other paradigm shifts are happening or should be happening?
In Oklahoma, and I think it's true particularly in the western states, we are seeing a huge shift in what we call the ick factor and dispelling the ick factor. And that is because of severe drought, we are really seeing an acceptance and a willingness to talk about using water, treated wastewater coming from our resource recovery facilities as drinking water. We have, in some states, direct potable reuse. This has been going on in Australia, other places in the world for a long time, but we had lots of water. So I think that's a big thing. We're seeing the move in the form of regulations. We're seeing communities willing to pay the cost to do that because it's just a need for drinking water. And so I think, for me personally, that's a huge shift.
I could think of several things when I think of what needs to happen in the way of paradigm shifts. I think one that the paradigm shift is probably already occurring right now. For our generation, for the past 30, 40 years, I think we have all just always understood that the infrastructure of America was something very special and very good. And upon it, our economy has been based. And the success we have seen our country have has been based on that infrastructure. But the reality is that infrastructure is aging dramatically now. And the paradigm shift that people need to have is that you can't count on that infrastructure to be there right now unless there is significant investment that occurs on our country. Our future success will be built upon what we do now in preparing infrastructure to get ready for it. That's probably one of the larger paradigm shifts that I can think of when I think of the big picture of the infrastructure. We need to help the next generations have the kind of America where we experienced, where there was good infrastructure. The other paradigm shift, I think, relates more to, I think a lot of people have for a long time thought as individuals that government's taking care of things and that design standards are the best they can be and that there's going to be the government agency there to solve problems and take care of everything. And I think the paradigm shift that needs to occur is people need to start being a lot more questioning about is the government that's in place, local government, state government, federal, whatever, really as solid as they are hoping they are? Are not only are laws in place, but is the structure in place to actually administer the laws? Is there staffing in place? Is there the support network they need? There's one thing for passing a law that says you should or shouldn't do anything, but if there's no structure behind that to make sure that that is complied with, I'm not certain that we've accomplished anything just by passing a law. There's a difference between budgets. You were talking about not only multiple budgets, but the hugest piece is, are there appropriations eventually made to back up those budgets? Quite often we see budgets that get created, but when the dollars actually get put into that program, why, they may appropriate less than half of the money than what the budget called for obvious various reasons. I understand the reasons. But the point is that the public's perception and needs to kind of change. They need to question a little bit what's behind the scenes and are things really being effectively backed up and done.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of their soapbox for me.
And with the Corps, I'd say that one of the key paradigm shifts that occurred was after Katrina, where they moved from speaking about hurricane levies as hurricane protection levies and instead call it a hurricane risk reduction levy and deal with it to the extent that when they are looking at whether or not to protect additional areas all along the Louisiana coast and in other areas as well, that they are looking at the worst word in the world, even worse than infrastructure, is non-structural ways of dealing with things, which generally means either moving people out of the floodplain or raising up their homes and actually spending money as part of a project on that instead of on levies.
That kind of following up on that. Yeah, it was very interesting to see those words changed. For the first 30 years of my career, I kept hearing the phrase flood control or flood control structure thrown about by everybody. And then Katrina hit. And the phrase control, that word, I think it left so many false impressions in people's mind. I was glad to see those words go. And they're now, instead of calling a levee a flood control structure, what you hear the federal people, the phrase they use, is a risk reduction structure, which goes back to the phrase that I threw in the PowerPoint along the way. There are residual risks out there, and we need to stop, and a paradigm shift is a good word for it. We need to stop giving the impression that things have been designed to ultimate risk. They aren't. They're designed quite often to a minimal risk level, and there's residual risk left in place. They are reduction structures. They aren't a removal kind of structure.
I was interested in what you had to say about reclaiming resources from wastewater. Oh, I'm Mariana Evans. I'm a professor here at the Gaylord College of Journalism. And I just finished writing an article for The Atlantic about our sewage infrastructure and focused on issues that are not so much Oklahoma specific in that in other parts of the country, the sanitary and storm sewers are combined. And I think that's less common here. But in any case, in our wastes, even here, you're going to have pharmaceuticals and places where the storm sewers come in and also industrial sewers. You have any number of contaminants in that water and sludge that comes out. How is that addressed? Does it limit where you can sell the reclaimed sludge? Does it limit the communities that can reclaim water for drinking? And are there technologies on the horizon that will help that?
So that's a lot of stuff in that one question. So I'm going to try to address pieces. So let's start with the easy one. You are correct. Here in Oklahoma, there are no combined sewers. That's illegal. One of the benefits of becoming a state in 1907 as opposed to 1700s. So we don't have the combined sewer issues. The pharmaceuticals issue, that is a big issue. It's going to continue to be an area where there is focus There is treatment that will, we believe, address most of that advanced oxidation, ozonation. There are a lot of advanced wastewater treatment that there's some pretty good literature that shows that it does address that. As far as when the water goes through the treatment plant, it's reclaimed, it's going to be used for its next purpose, whatever that is. Many states, Oklahoma included, have rules. You can go in Oklahoma to the DEQ website under rules and regulations. There are water reuse chapters. What it does is it breaks down what is the intended use of the water, and then it talks about what kind of monitoring is required and what kinds of parameters, and only water that meets those certain conditions can be used for whatever the use is. We do not have the potable in there yet. That's still being worked on. But we do have for watering Little League ball fields. I mean, there are treatment standards for that. It's not quite drinking water standards, but it does involve a lot of advanced treatment. The city of Norman right now can treat to what they call a Category 3 in the rules. So that's two steps below what potable would be. But the water can be used for golf courses. It can be used for industrial purposes. It can be used for oil and gas purposes. But you can't, you know, spray it someplace. You're going to have the kids rolling around where you're going to be drinking it. So it is specific to each state and how they address that. The Environmental Protection Agency and CDC have not weighed in on level of treatment for particular uses, but many states, I think there are 14 or 16 states that do have water reuse regulations in place, monitoring and testing and treatment standards. They lump pharmaceuticals into a category of emerging contaminants, and that's where you get into that advanced oxidation, advanced wastewater treatment, ozonation, where it does get pretty expensive. You have to really want to do it. I think if you truly want to address it, as an example, the city of Oklahoma City is looking at potential indirect potable reuse to definitely take care of the pharmaceuticals, doubles the cost from $50 million to $100 million to do that advanced treatment for the volume of water they're talking about. So there is treatment out there. It's really expensive. I assume there will be more treatment developed, and hopefully that cost will come down over time, but we'll see.
So I think we pretty much run out of time looking at the people streaming by. I want to thank both of our panelists for coming today, and a reminder that there's some stuff on the back table for you. And thank you as well for coming out and hearing us. Thank you very much.